It is Friday, September 22nd, and it's a little earlier than normal. We normally come to you at 1 o'clock. It's 12 o'clock noon. This is a huge week, biggest week we've had yet, talking about the startup security notes of interest. Matt Alderman is here, the wizard of entrepreneurship, and we're going to tackle it. We're going to go a little out of order this week. We're going to start out with a quick startup articles and discussions, some things to think about this week, especially as we round out the year. And then we have 11 different stories. So big moves in the world of security this week we're going to break down. And then after a brief break, we're going to be joined by Don Prezet and Tim Broom of IT Pro TV. And you know there's a lot there we're going to talk about and look into. So this is going to be a great show. Grab something to drink. You're going to need some refreshments for this one because we're going to break it down pretty fun. Startup Security Weekly number 56 starts now.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Startup Security Weekly. I need it from the top. Brought to you by, make sure your team is prepared to fight off the latest cybersecurity threat. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team skills up to date. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide, so there's no need to send staff to off-site training. Their team solution provides access to a supervisor portal for full control over your team's training schedule and group analytics. Go to itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30 to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal.
All right. I know typically this is where Paul gets to refer to me as a beach bum. I think we're going to change it to sand hobo. I like that a lot better. But we've got the wizard this week, the wizard of entrepreneurship. I didn't know if Matt, I don't know if you know you're called the wizard, but from now on, in my world, you're going to be the wizard. I'd call you the wizard of value, but I think this is the third week in a row you and I have managed to be together on some Security Weekly property. So welcome back, and I know we got a lot to dig into today.
Yeah, we do. Thanks. You know, it's always fun when Paul or somebody misses, so I get to come on and fill in, and it's been a regular basis lately, so it's all good.
I'm digging it, so I'm glad you're here. All right, let me grab a couple announcements. We're going to see if I do a little bit better this week than I did last week. SANS Hackfest, November 13th to 20th. It's in Bethesda, Maryland. That's right outside of Washington, D.C. Hackfest is SANS' most offense-focused training event of the year. It includes the two-day summit, 3 nights of Net Wars with Coinapalooza, 1 night of Cyber City Missions, and a super secret challenge, all alongside 9 courses taught by their top pen test course authors and instructors. The Hackfest Summit, November 13th to 14th, is 2 days of informative and technical talks curated by SANS fellow and friend of the podcast, Ed Scoutis. Paul's going to be presenting a talk, so you know you're going to go to this. Paul's going to present a talk, How to Defend Against Penetration Testers and Win. You want to win, don't you? So you're going to go to this. Register at sans.org/hackfest17. Security Weekly listeners can save $300 off the 2-day Hackfest Summit by using the discount code Hackfest17 at registration. Besides CT, besides the Connecticut, it's a day-long information security conference in Southington, Connecticut, October 7th, 2017. They have an exciting lineup of speakers and a challenging CTF waiting for you to take your best shot. Due to an incredible response, general admission tickets are currently sold out. So you got 2 ways you can make this work for you. There's a wait list available through Eventbrite, so you can go. You can sign up through that link at bsidect.org. And as tickets become available, they're going to let you know, and you're going to get a chance to jump in and get some. But the other way you can do this, and this is a way to sponsor them and help the community, they have some sponsorship packages that include tickets, and they're still available. So if you think that's you and you think that that helps, visit them, bsidect.org. Check it out. All right, so I've already told you, we've got 11 different things we're going to talk about, but I never want to skip some of these different opportunities here to just kind of talk about startup life and other stuff. And I think what's interesting, I love it, Matt, when you're on the program and you and I get to talk about it because we look at value a lot. I've been having a lot more conversations with enterprise leaders. In fact, I've got a workshop coming up in Dallas in the end of October. And so if anybody else is is interested, I'd be happy to talk. Spend a little extra time in Dallas because I love it down there. The enterprise is looking at a lot of stuff that we're doing, and so a lot of people say to me, "Well, it's startup. You guys are talking about startups. How does it impact me in the enterprise?" What I would say is, when we start and we talk about these articles in the discussion, we're looking at things around leadership, because if you want to be successful in a startup today, leadership matters. Your ability to market, your ability to influence. But what's interesting is, if you think about the role of a modern security leader today, if you're in the enterprise, you've got to get budget. Okay, well, that's selling. You've got to deliver on your goods. You've got to build the relationships. You've got to be able to focus your team. You can't do it all. And so there's a tremendous amount of parallels between the two. And so I think, you know, the reason that you see Matt and I bouncing between Enterprise Security Weekly and here frequently and filling in and contributing and talking about it is because the two programs are really related. So when you come here, what we're going to talk about, and we're going to keep this tight because there's a lot to talk about in the world of security today. Think about this from the perspective of, how does this help me do my job better? Whether you're that enterprise security leader or you're in the startup, some of you are both. You're enterprise security leaders and you're kind of going down a startup path, or you're an investor and you want to get a better sense of how to evaluate the teams and such. That's a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about. So one of the first stories I pulled up this week is, how do you build successful products? And this is a number of experts that weigh in. Matt, you've got a tremendous amount of experience here. I'm going to sum it up the way I saw it. Focus, focus, focus. Like, the point to it is, if you want to be good at it, you've got to be really focused on what you do. And you and I talk about this all the time, right? What's the problem you solve? What value do you create solving that? But when you look at this, if you're advising somebody today, they're trying to get something done, and they want to build a product. And again, this work internal as much as external. What do you think? Did anything in this article resonate with you, or do you think we missed it and there's something people need to think about better?
Well, look, to me, it's the foundational stuff you just said, right? What's the market problem? You know, are there other people out in the industry trying to solve it? You know, and then what's your value associated with that? And that starts to drive the focus. Like, what am I building? How do I enhance that value back to the market to solve that problem in a unique or different way? And it's a step that a lot of people skip. Truly, you know, typical startups are going to come out, they have an idea, they see something wrong, they start building technology, and then they try to go get some traction. If they just step back a couple steps and said, okay, can I articulate the problem, both sometimes at the market level and the technology level, but can you articulate that true problem? And then you better have an idea of why you're out trying to solve this thing and how you solve it and what makes you unique, and then drive that value. That will set your focus for everything else you do, because that means you know what you're going to communicate to the market, you know what you're going to attempt to build and really kind of rally around from a value proposition, and it really sets that tone, right? And I think that's a step that a lot of people just skip up front sometimes, and to me, that's the starting point. And obviously, that's the work I've been doing lately with some of these startups, is just kind of going back to the basics, laying out a base structure. It's not super difficult, by the way, and once you get it, things start to click. You're like, oh yeah, that's what we need to do, and then you can focus the rest of your activities from there.
Yeah, I find too, when people get to that point, and they, I'll give you a quick example, and you certainly come across this as well. I did some work here in the state of South Carolina. A lot of people in our country and in the world are saying, well, how do we get more students involved in cybersecurity? What do we need to do? And so if you talk to a lot of people in security, they'll say, well, you know, the problem is teachers don't know what they're doing. We don't have enough teachers. We need to pay teachers more, right? And so I had people say this, and I said, well, does anybody ask the teachers what the problem is? And they said, no, that's a good idea. Hey, we've got a meeting with a bunch of teachers. Why don't you come to it? So I did some keynote. And actually, in fact, what I did instead of the keynote is I said, if you guys want to hear me talk, I'm happy to. But what if would it be cool if we just kind of asked questions and had a conversation? And they said, sure. So I kind of described what everybody else said to them, and I could watch their eyes. And I said, okay, you guys tell me what the problem was. And I was not surprised. But what I found was the problem wasn't that they didn't feel that they were paid enough. The problem wasn't that they didn't feel that they got support, or they didn't know how to do it, or they didn't know security. Their problem was actually really simple. They didn't have the buy-in that they needed from their executives. So the principals and the supervisors and the other people in the chain didn't understand why we'd be teaching school in a high school, and what that would, or security rather, in a high school, and what that would mean and what kind of risk they would have. Number two, They pointed this out. And this was shocking. This might be more to South Carolina. Most of the technical security stuff is in a technical track, what we used to call VoTech when I was a kid. I don't know what they call it anymore. It's fancy now. But the point is, if you're an honor student, you're almost excluded from this particular track, which seems exceptionally counterintuitive to me. Number three, parents don't understand it. If you say, hey, I want little Johnny to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, people get that. Hey, I want him to do security stuff. Wait, he wants to be a hacker? Is he going to get in trouble for that? I don't think so. Or, you know, or he's not my kid or whatever. Those were the problems. It's not at all what anybody said. It's not this, we've got to figure out how to get businesses to create money, or we need to go train these teachers. That wasn't the problem. That's not a problem at all. And we've spent so much time and effort telling ourselves what the problem was, that when we actually went to the people that were on the front lines that were trying to solve the problem and asked them where they needed help, it was far easier to solve. Well, I'm not sure we solved it. It was far easier to understand. I think that's your point. You know, people get excited. They get spun up. They've got a very limited perspective, but they get good with it. And I think when people realize, gosh, if you just ask people, they'll tell you. And if you can get good at that, then it makes everything easier. But there's this one other part it has in here, and I'm curious how you handle this, Matt. It says, so the advice is you say no to one-off customizations as you move up market. Paul and I have talked about this a couple of times, so I'm curious your take on it. So you've got a product, you're excited, you're getting your traction, you've got your customers in, and then somebody says, oh, can you make it work this way, or can you do this? And at first blush, I mean, they're throwing money at you, and they're a good customer, and you don't want to lose them, and you want their testimonial. And so you kind of go, oh, okay, we can do that. How do you help companies handle that? How do you help them figure out how to build a product that's good for a lot of people without getting into too many one-offs that really don't have a return? Is there any ideas or strategies that people need to think about when they get in this pattern?
Yeah, it gets interesting, right? Because as a startup, you're under pressure to get those first customers on, and sometimes you have to do some customization to get that initial proof point or proof points, right? What you want to try to do, sometimes this is easier said than done, which is one-offs are something that are configurable that you can somehow isolate from the rest of the core code, mm-hmm. right? And so can you meet that requirement through a customization that you can feature flag turn off and not expose to anybody else that doesn't divert the entire product? Sometimes that's easy. Sometimes that's not very hard, depending on what it is. As you get later and later stage in a company and you're building out a broader customer base, doing one-offs gets really, really tough, because it can divert resources from going after a much broader market. And this is, it's been a challenge everywhere. I mean, Tenable had this with the federal government stuff, right? There's a lot of requirements that FedGov wanted to put onto the platform. Those are things that we had to do that were really one-offs for the U.S. federal government, not for the rest of the customers. So as long as you can isolate that code or leverage it for commercial use elsewhere, great, but it is a hard balance at times to do that. The way we used to try to do it when I did control path and some of the other stuff, so we tried to do that through configurations and make that a little easier to deal with those one-offs through a configuration, not through custom code. That way you're not kind of affecting the core platform code. You do it through like a database configuration or something like that. So
I like that.
Those
a lot
would be recommendations. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because one of the things that I've noticed is the startups that tend to focus, right, they find their niche, and that may mean even a particular industry. So, you know, you're really good at hospital tech or whatever. Good, go own that. But I watch a lot of them get really nervous, and they say, but we could be bigger, and if all I do is focus on that, then won't I box myself out of all these others? And what I always try to explain is, if you can go get really good at one, you have so much evidence and proof that expanding out to the next one makes sense. But I like your approach. If we can get people to think about, you know, the modularity of it and configurations, then they're not necessarily coding themselves into a black hole. So
right. Don't hard code it, right? So perfect example, PCI, right? If you hard code everything to PCI, guess what? It's going to be really, really hard to change it. But if you created a base structure that allowed you to do PCI through configuration and then, oh, I want to do it for some other regulation, for example, then you've got the core capabilities there. Now it's a customization. It's content driven, not custom code driven. And that sometimes that's still a challenge for startups, the custom code route versus the configuration route. Because to do it right in configuration means you have to spend a little more time building the right underlying architecture but then it gives you the flexibility to continue to expand.
It's kind of paradoxical, right? Doesn't that mean then, Matt, you've got to better understand the problem you're trying to solve? Like, you've got to really understand the problem so you code for the problem but leave the branches.
And maybe the target customer and the buyer persona and yeah.
Yeah, right. The stuff we like to skip over because it's less sexy for a lot of people. I threw this article in, Hiring for Discipline You Know a Little About. It's got three ideas. I wanted to call out one I really liked. So the idea is, all right, so you're a startup and I need different things, right? I need sales. I need marketing. These are things I never liked, especially if you're in security. But I also might need development. I'm not a developer. I need all these different types of things. And one of the things that was suggested, and this is a personal favorite of mine, which is do the jobs yourself. Go figure it out. I mean, there's no substitute for experience, and there's no substitute for experience when it really matters. So if you've never sold, learning how to sell, it's a valuable experience. That doesn't mean you need to be a salesperson, but understanding it. But here's the advice I would have for this in specific. If you're going to go learn how to sell, go learn how to sell. Go take a course. Go get some books. Go understand it. There's a process and a methodology to it, and there's a number of different ones. Pick the one you like. Each of them has some level of merit, but that's going to help you understand what works for you and your company, and then you have that firsthand experience, so you're going to be slightly better positioned now when you interview somebody else to replace you. You know what it's like. You know what it's going to be like for them, but you also know the questions you need to ask. Maybe you can figure out how to hire for the things you didn't do as well. I like that. Second one it talks about is enlisting experts. So you go in asking for help. And then the third one is, you know, just hire entry-level people and see how it works out and pull them up. I like that one the least, even in security, right? Because the thing I look at here is I think it works in security. And I keep seeing so many security teams in general just going, oh, I need a security, right? What do we hear? I need a unicorn. They've got to be able to do all these things. They've got to have 10 years of experience, but they got to be willing to work for a first-year entry-level salary. And it's like, wait, what? And what I find is, a lot of the folks running these teams don't actually know how to accomplish those jobs. And I think if we could start to narrow down a little bit better what you actually expect somebody to do, and you had some experience with that, you're going to know really quick if that person can fit your environment or not, or ask people. But again, that clarity, right? To me, this is still saying, what problem are you trying to solve? And if you just spitball it, you know, sales, what kind of sales, right? I don't know if we talked about this on air or not, but you know, last week you and I, Matt, talked about, like, is it direct sales? Is it channel sales? Are you working with the enterprise or the SMB? Like it's all different sales. Are you selling a product? Are you selling a service? Are you selling both? All totally different ways of doing stuff. How do you think about this when you're looking to hire somebody? If it's something that maybe you don't have as much direct experience with, although I think you're pretty broad in terms of your experience, advice for somebody else?
Yeah, well, a couple of the recommendations in here are interesting, and I kind of agree with you on the third point because it kind of counterproductive to one of the other articles you have later, right? Which is hire entry level folks and see how it goes. Look, if you've been in the role, if you've done the role, even in somewhere back in your past, you have some level of experience of how you want to hire for the role. And in an early stage startup, look, founders are doing a lot of stuff, right? They're out doing sales, they're out doing initial marketing, they're out doing investor raises. They're kind of a jack of all trades, master of none in the earliest of days. They can't focus on one specific thing necessarily. And so having gone out and talked to customers about your message and the sales and is there interest gives you an idea of, hey, these are the types of customers we're seeing. These are the types of interests we have. So when I go out and hire a salesperson, look, I kind of know what customers are looking for. So let me find somebody that, you know, can really help us accelerate those kinds of areas. I actually did an interview yesterday with a sales leader for one of the companies I'm consulting with now. And to me, it all boils down about culture. Right, you've got some sales executives that want to go out and put territory managers and SEs all over the place and drive a big sales team. You have others that are fully on board with self-service models to say, hey, I'd love people to get on the platform really, really easy, and then I'll figure out how to cross-sell, upsell them, right? Those are two different philosophies from a sales perspective. And if you haven't experienced aspects of that, it'll be hard for you to find the right sales leader to bring into your organization. So fully agree. On the less experienced side, I don't know. to me, you've got to bring in, we talked about this last week, the advisor stuff, right? I think we talked about advisors versus mentors.
Yep.
Leverage advisors where you can in the early days, right? That's some of the work that I'm doing. And if you look at some of these startups, they're bringing in other industry advisors, kind of experts, to help with some of the guidance early on. But when you go to hire people, I like bringing in somebody senior who's been there, done that, can do the work, can get things going. Once you get traction, then you can start to hire out the rest of the team. And that's when you can bring in some less experienced people to kind of mentor and teach through the process. But I think if you don't nail things like go-to-market and sales approaches early with someone who's been there, done that, you're going to burn a lot of cash before you get
spin,
any
right?
traction in the industry. Yeah, it's huge.
Yep, and it's a fantastic segue to the next one, and I'm curious, and I'm actually curious if you think this is the most important startup question. You and I have talked a lot when we're about to transition to this. There are some of the companies we're going to cover today. They've had some pretty interesting raises in terms of debt versus seed versus debt versus rounds versus A again, and there's a lot there, and there's a bunch that we're going to cover in it. So here's their question: when do we run out of money? And are we on track to reach the milestones that we need for successful financing before then? And now, again, you've got a lot of experience here. I like the way that they just kind of broke this down, and they basically said, look, you're either searching for your product market fit, right? So that's your early stage. You're trying to get to that, I would usually say your unit economics, but you're trying to figure out how to be profitable and repeatable. And that's your A-B stage, and then you're scaling the business, and that's your growth stage. That's when it's okay. We're good and we know how it works. Now we're going to go make it happen. And so they kind of cover some of the risks in here. I think it's a great question. I mean, you know, especially if you're taking funding, are you doing the right stuff and do you have enough money to get you to the next round? What do you think? Is there a better question to ask, or do you like the way this laid it out?
Close. I have one slight change in the flow. Look, early on, you're trying to get kind of that solve that market problem and try to say, hey, do I have something here that's unique and differentiated? And seed rounds are really good at, I think, doing aspects of that is getting some early traction, right? So a seed round's good to get, you know, the initial founders, a few developers in the corner and start to build out a product that you can POC and you can start to get momentum around. And once you get some market traction, it's like, okay, now I need to figure out how to get more traction. And so I wouldn't worry about profitability at this stage, which was kind of your phase two. It's more about, okay, I got to start to scale up the business to start to go capture more and more of this market. At some point down the road, profitability comes into play. I don't know that it comes in kind of at phase two for an A-B round. A-B rounds to me are really growth rounds where you've got market validation. Now you're ready to go out, hire aspects of the team to get the message out, to get the sales going, start to get that revenue growth. Don't worry about profitability at this stage. Not quite yet. As you get into later rounds, B's and C's, now you got to start thinking about potential exit and IPOs and other things. And then profitability, I think, does start to come on the radar screen. But I wouldn't worry about profitability too early yet because you got to get some of that initial market traction and growth. And I don't want, you know, really, you don't want to worry about profitability that early in the process.
No, I'm actually really glad you brought that up too, because one of the things that we've bounced around for the last year on is, does profitability matter? And it's becoming one of those things where you get a hardcore group of people who say no. You get a hard group of people who say yes. And I find myself kind of in the middle going, well, it depends. And as I was listening to you talk about it, I agree with everything you said. I mean, if you're figuring out product market fit, you've got a appropriate seed round, you're into your A round, yeah, profitability is probably not as important. What I would say is you need to show that you can be profitable, right? As opposed to, right? So just burning cash, right? Throwing cash on the ground and lighting that on fire, that's not going to get anybody anywhere. But to your point, turning an actual profit versus here's our pathway to profitability, here's when it's going to work, and here's why, right? Here's why our unit economics are going to support that. And, you know, P.S., it's going to take us two more years to get there. I think that that's a play in a lot of places. But that also means that you understand your unit economics and you understand your cash rate and you understand there's all sorts of numbers that we've covered at different points to be able to calculate out based on lifetime value of customer and cost of acquisition, and even when and how they pay and how you're financing everything. That'll drive a lot of those decisions for you. I'll be candid. I find a lot of startups don't know that. And if you don't know that, then you better be profitable because that's the only way you're going to survive.
Yeah, well, you have to understand burn rates, right? You have to understand I've got cash, and as I hire, I'm burning cash. And I should be offsetting some of that burn with revenue as revenue comes in the door. And so at some point, you start to see where your burn rates start to decrease and then eventually shift the other way where you're starting to turn to profitability. And that doesn't have to happen day one. Doesn't even have to happen a year from now. Look, there's a lot of companies that have gone public without profitability.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So look, some people will tell you, I'll trade a point of margin for a point of growth any day of the week. That works to an extent, don't get me wrong. But if you're going to go into the public market, here's where I shift. If you're a startup and you understand when you can hit profitability and you're accelerating capturing market at high growth rates and you're in a strategic acquisition, profitability doesn't necessarily matter. Okay, it's okay because they're buying you for the growth and the market share and some of those things. If you're going public, then I think profitability starts to matter. And the perfect example I have is Qualys versus Rapid7. If you look at market valuations, look, Qualys has slower growth but profitable. They were profitable when they entered the market, and they get credit for that in their stock market valuation. Where you look at Rapid7, who has higher growth, but they're not profitable yet, I think they take a little bit of a ding in the public markets. That's the difference between profitability and not profitability.
Wow, and there's a lot there, too, to think about. I want to get us to the stories. All right, I want to just point something out in this one, and if you've got anything you want to talk about, but this former Yelp COO, How to Survive the Valley of Death of the Startup. It's got some ideas. To be fair, I like some of them. I don't like others. I want to call one out, though. Because I see this a lot, and this is a real bugaboo for me. Number four, 50% of staff will hear what you say, so overinvest in internal communication. I'm going to make it a quick soapbox. This is the worst advice I've ever heard. Here's what they're trying to say, and if they just said it this way, pay attention to your internal communication. If you're going to invest in anything, invest in the structure so that you can communicate clearly and consistently and that people have a way for their voices to be heard. What I see most times is people don't do that. And what they'll hear is, right, we did this for maybe the first decade of the century. It was, effective leaders communicate effectively. And so I'm the guy who raised my hand, go, what does that mean? Well, you're effective and stuff. And so then when that didn't take and they tried that for a decade, then we've moved into this whole new shift of, you know what good leaders do? They over-communicate. No, they don't. Because if you're communicating crap, and you're over-communicating it, then you're over-communicating crap. So if you're creating friction and you're pissing people off and you're confusing them and you over-communicate, then guess what? You're totally screwing that up. So if you just say, well, over-invest in it, so now I need to have Slack and email and, we're Office 365, so we got Yammer too in there. Oh, and then I text message people, and then sometimes I call them on the phone, and then we have our scheduled meetings. I've seen this in startups, and people look around and they go, I don't know what channel I'm supposed to follow. I don't know who I'm supposed to talk to. I don't know how to escalate this, and nobody's listening to me. So all I would say is this is a great concept, but what in my experience, and this is where I spend the bulk of my time looking at straight talk and communication, do people have a voice? Do they have a mechanism to exercise that voice? And when they do, is it actually heard and acted on? If you focus on that, then this is less of a problem. But that's just – I get
part of it's but part of it's culture, right? And it comes from the CEO down. What's the culture in the environment, right? If the CEO is open, has the open door policy. Look, it will happen naturally.
And the only challenge I'll add is because this is talking too about when you scale up to teams of 100. Right. When it's 10 to 15 people, that does tend to happen. But when you've got 100 people trying to go in 20 different directions, it gets nutty. And so when people say overinvest in communication, what we tend to do is we make it worse. All I would argue is invest in the structure and invest in training people on that structure. Structure gets you substance. Structure is the way you overcome friction. That was kind of my point on it. The rest of the stuff's interesting. This last one, because we got so many stories to get to here, Matt. This was at Burning Man while your startup burns. But basically what it was saying is if you're in a startup and you're running it. So this one was specific to going to Burning Man. But then they called out Ibiza. They called out South by Southwest. The thing I find is I have come across a surprising number of startup founders and startup leaders where they really need to be at the helm of their companies. But, man, they are always at a freaking conference. And if you say to them, are you getting value out of the conference? Oh, yeah, I got to be there. Cool. Well, how many leads did you get? Well, I mean, you know, but I got to be there. So I like this to basically say, is your ship running properly? If so, sure, you can check out. Now, this is talking about these big name events where it's like, I'm there, so I'm a somebody. But, you know, we have this in security, too. And I'm always looking at people going, is this the best use of your time? Or are you better off working with your team and overinvesting in communication and doing all that type of stuff? So what's your take on it? Like, how do you find the right balance between, especially as a security startup, where you want to go connect with enterprise leaders?
I have one simple rule. If you're not presenting, don't go.
There you go.
Look, if you're sending your founder and an executive to a conference event, and they are not speaking at the event, why are they going? Unless they're trying to do biz dev or something behind the scenes because, you know, they want a strategic alliance relationship, maybe. But
that's
in the early days,
tell you too.
Yeah,
that's always
yeah.
their excuse, Matt. Well, I mean, I'm not speaking, but do you know who's going to be there? Do you know all these people I can meet?
Yeah, well, in the earliest of stages, we just went through this discussion with one of the companies I've been working on. I'm like, guys, we're not ready. We're just not ready. Right. Okay, maybe we can get a speaking slot. I can go out and deliver a 20-minute high-level story. I can do it. But is it really worth the investment? I mean, are you going to spend $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 to go out to an event for 20 minutes that – then what, right?
So that's the right question.
I'm not a big I couldn't justify it, right? I could not justify it. I'm like, it's great exposure, but is it at the right time? Can we really leverage that investment the right way? And the answer was no. And if you can't answer those questions honestly, then just don't go.
You know what I like about it too, as I'm listening to you think about it, if you can't, I love this concept of falling in love with the problem publicly. If you're going to go to the event, but you're not able to fall in love with that problem publicly, speaking slot or not, but like you're not really clear on that problem to the point people go, how do you do that? Get me in. Then don't go. You're wasting your time. But then I think what you also pointed out is that second point. All right, so they got a guy like you or me. They come, we can tell the story. People are going to be excited about it. Then what? Are you going to follow up on that lead? Are you prepared to work with them? Can you sort out the wheat from the chaff? Who are you looking for? Who's your target? Yeah, if you can't answer those questions, being there to be a somebody, to hope that you're going to meet that one person who really needs what you do and has a check ready, if that happened to you, call us, tell us, send us a note.
I'd
love to talk to you. But.
I'd love to. But yeah, I mean, if you don't have a way to follow up on any lead that comes up, if you don't have a product that's ready to actually POC or GA, I mean, you're just wasting your time and you're wasting money.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about wasting money. What a horrible way to lead into the startup and the security notes of interest. We'll start with one that people might think is a little interesting, but Slack, $250 million, Series G, they're big growth mode now, $5 billion valuation, thing I thought's interesting. And this came up, in fact, I think you and I talked about this during one of the earlier shows. So this was right around the time Amazon went for Whole Foods. The rumor that morning was, oh, look, Amazon's going to buy Slack. They're going to buy Slack, or they're at least going to invest in Slack. And by like Friday afternoon, it was, our bad, they're going to go ahead and buy Whole Foods. And but, you know, they still like Slack, and so they'll throw some cash their way. And that didn't really go so far. April 2016, Slack is valued at $3.8 billion, took a $200 million round, and it just took a $250 million round, $5.1 billion valuation. What do you think?
If you want to talk about definition of unicorns, here it is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was interesting when Amazon was looking at them because, look, you know, if you think about where Amazon on the web services side is and the cloud adoption and DevOps and all this other stuff, makes perfect sense. You know, yeah. Slack's gaining a ton of momentum in the industry as that new engagement platform for communication. And I've been tracking these guys for a little while. I think it's really interesting. I think it's a little high valuation. You know, there's a 20 plus Xer on this valuation. You know, that's, I mean, that's huge, right? So, look, the only exit now is probably an IPO or, you know, somebody who wants to pay just a boatload for the organization. We'll see where this goes. But
or they're going to get a down round, right? Or it's going to be one of those Slack was sold for an undisclosed amount. Like it's,
yeah, but it could be. But
so how do you think then Office 365 plays against it, right? Because they've got Yammer. Office 365, I got to tell you, I converted over from the Google and the G Suite apps to Office 365. And the new question I ask myself before I go into anything new, and actually we use Slack over Yammer, is I look at it and I go, okay, is this already included or do I need a different tool to go do it? And I'm starting more and more to find that Microsoft, especially for us smaller businesses, their investments seem to be paying off. Is that a risk to Slack or... Nope, Slack's in a totally different marketplace, and they can sustain that $5 billion valuation.
So I think Slack's in a different market. I think Office 365 is great for companies that are all in with the Microsoft kind of suite. But I see a lot of startups that are not Microsoft-based. They're not running Windows. They're not using Office products. They're Amazon. They're Google. Slack fits into that really, really well. Not that Hangouts isn't something to use, but yeah, I don't know if you've ever used Hangouts. It's a
I have. It's horrible. It feels like it's the bastard child that they left off to the side. They didn't.
Yeah, I mean, if they could make that thing more bandwidth efficient, I think more people would use it. But look, if you look at every startup, they're running their stuff in AWS. They're a Google Docs customer, and they've all got Slack channels all over the place. I mean, that's the norm in this environment. And the DevOps teams are using it because it's integrated into their other processes. Even if you're a Microsoft shop, your developers probably aren't using Yammer. They're using Slack.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the experience between the two, I like Slack much better. And Slack lets you play with Giphy, and that's just a lot of fun. So, yeah, it's going to be curious to see where that goes. And I think there are security implications. The other news this week, Slack said, hey, it's easier to invite people that aren't in your organization now to participate. So I think we're going to see – it's going to be interesting to see how this continues. Another big numbers, McAfee, $4.8 billion in debt. I tell you, I saw the headline, and I went – that's interesting. Didn't they just spin out? And so it turns out when you dig into it, it's because the way that they spun out, Intel kept 49%, and Intel essentially floated them alone. So when they spun out, they didn't have audited books. When you don't have audited books, it means getting your financing is really tough. So they gave them a very generous 7% loan. Now, if you're listening at home and you're like, 7%, that's isn't that fine? No, they're not buying a car. $2 billion of financing that they needed to repay at 7% interest. And you and I talked before the show, the marketplace is like, you know, 1%, 2%. It's a huge premium.
Yeah. And yeah, so, I mean, if you think about your bank account, right? If you're making 1% on your bank account, you're lucky. 7% is a high interest rate. If you're buying a house, you're probably at like 4%. Okay. Yeah. So 7% is still pretty darn high.
Yeah. Now, I posited this, and I'm kind of wondering if this was a way to encourage them to get their financing in place, right? Because I could see how you spin off and you got $2 billion out there, and you know, it seems like a lot of money, but even to an Intel, $2 billion hung up in a balance sheet's a lot of money. And if you want this group to get their books audited and to get their stuff squared away and to be a little bit healthier, you know, it's not quite usury at 7%, but at least there's enough of a penalty there that they want to get that off their books. But anyway, that's really what this looks at. It's $4.8 billion in debt. It a full $2 billion of that is to repay that. It's financing. It's getting them ready for IPO. It's kind of setting stuff up this way. McAfee, do they stay a player, do you think? You know, do they trade on their name and the things that they've done over the last couple of years? Or is this just going to be interesting to watch, but you're not sure much is going to come out of it?
Yeah, you know, obviously, when Chris Young went over, you know, part of what he's trying to do is kind of figure out the next version of McAfee, right? And they made some divestitures with MVM, the old Foundstone product,
yep,
and kind of realigning and right-sizing the portfolio. I'll wait to see where it ends up, right? I haven't dug into them lately, right? But look, a lot of people think of Symantec and McAfee kind of in the same boat. They've got the antivirus side, some of the endpoint stuff. They've got Nitro in the portfolio. So depending on kind of where they want to go next, it'll be interesting to see where they go. I'm not sure they're an attractive IPO where they currently are. There's probably other names out there that are really, really attractive for IPOs. And look, they haven't gone. So the financials have to be there. The story's got to be there. I just don't know when somebody like a McAfee could go.
I think that's the key. Go back to a couple weeks ago when we talked about categories. We talked about telling the story. And you pointed out something I think is really important. You've got to be able to deliver on your category and your story today, but you've got to be thinking about what comes next. McAfee isn't McAfee anymore. Whatever they are going forward, this is their opportunity to come tell us a good story. And tapping Chris into that position, we covered that a little bit because I for one, was kind of energized by it. I was like, this is exciting. But, you know, you go to Aller now and you look at his approval rating. It's down significantly. I haven't really heard much from him. I don't see any splashes. I don't see him falling in love with the problem. I don't see anybody from McAfee stepping up and saying, okay, the situation's changed, and look at our opportunity. We've got all of this heritage and legacy. We've got these connections with Intel. The chips are changing. The things we can do are different, and this is how we're going to do it. It just kind of feels like they're just shuffling paper around and trying to figure it out. So I'll be curious to see where it goes. On that path, SecureAuth. So SecureAuth does identity, single sign-on identity stuff. They got acquired for $225 million.
$225 million.
And OPS, they're going to merge with Core Security. This is one of those things that, you know, I always like to be really positive. So I guess all I'll say is I've always struggled trying to understand what the core of Core Security did. And so SecureAuth is out there, right? Identity's hot. Identity has been confusing for 20 years. And as we proliferate devices and access and applications and now everything is cloud, identity has again popped up, and this becomes a really big opportunity. So SecureAuth merging with Core. So basically, K1 stepped in, and was it they have Toba, right? K1 stepped in. Here's $225 million. And in the one release we've linked to, the CEO of they're going to merge. It's going to be a new company, and the CEO of SecureAuth is going to carry it forward. Stay tuned. It's going to be really exciting. I'm interested.
So this is this is a manufacturer buyout, right? This is taking two companies, putting them together, going, okay, what are we going to do with this thing now? Core has had an interesting run over the past few years, right? In the early days, you know, they were known for their exploit stuff, moved into what is now known as threat and vulnerability management, but never really got a lot of traction, went through a bunch of changes in that space. Now, here comes SecureAuth. They're going to manufacture the combination. Here's the opportunity, though, right? Because I looked at this a little bit and said, okay, how would these two pieces fit together? If I can start to correlate identity and threat and vulnerability information and start building out more of an intelligent identity authentication set of capabilities, then I think there's something here. Core's got some good pieces underneath that if leveraged correctly with SecureAuth could make some improvements in the identity side of some of the challenges that we're facing. That's where I see the potential opportunity, but they're like, just hold on. New company name coming in 2018. So they've got a few months to try to figure aspects of this out.
I
see the potential fit.
When you do a manufactured buyout like this, are you good with them saying, hey, we're coming together and in 4 months, maybe five, maybe six, we'll tell you what our name is? Like,
I would have tried to do it up front. I really would have tried
me too. This
set
feels
the story
like
up front to say, this is what we're going to do. This is what it's going to become. Stay tuned for more information. But what they basically said is, look, we bought SecureAuth. We're going to combine them with Core Security, and we're not quite sure what we're going to do with them yet. So wait.
But it's going to be awesome.
I don't think that helps either business right now in the interim, because customers are going to be like,
wait, what?
What does that mean for me for the next 4 months?
I'm looking at the website. It's a better approach to securing the enterprise in real time. Network and endpoint security with a strong identity layer. These are words that I don't know about you, but I whoever sent these words to me, I'd say, like, right, so you just said a whole bunch of nothing in one shot and stop. Like, I don't understand. But to your point, if we can start to correlate identity with different things that are happening, I mean, we already see people trying to do this with UBA. We already see people now looking at stuff differently. I'll tell you what, I'll leave open. It could be interesting. And maybe we'll even get them on the program. We'll get a chance to talk to them about it. So,
yeah, like I said, the opportunity here is to bring the identity dimension into the traditional threat and vulnerability management side. Because to me, the user identity is just another asset. And so it's another dimension of asset. And when correlated correctly, could provide some very interesting capabilities yet to be seen.
So now I'm really curious. I want to see if they acquire anybody else as they're going through it. And I want to kind of see if they define a new category as they go forward, or if they try to pick a default category and try to be better in that category, which I think is going to be really challenging. $225 million, I mean, it's a big number, but it's not huge. So they've got room to grow and room to do stuff differently. Digital Shadows. So we're talking about risk management. Digital Shadows, Series C, $26 million. Now, when you go look at their funding stuff, at least in Aller, looks like they've taken $48 million or more, but some of the rounds, the information here doesn't seem complete as I took a look at it. Now, Aller is crowdsourced, and it's great. I love it. I didn't cross-check this one against Crunchbase today. But they start out with an equity round at $8 million, and then they jumped right to a Series B. So it's interesting. I mean, maybe that was their A round. They called it something different. Anyway, $48 million for digital risk management. So it's like, what, threat intel, but a little bit different? What do you think? Digital Shadows and a $46 million raise.
This is a weird space for me. I think Forrester is the one who created this digital risk management monitoring space. So, right. So what you've got here is Digital Shadows and Risk IQ, maybe a Risk Recon and some of these guys, right? So kind of the external threat side of the equation. So take what most customers have done internally with threat intelligence, and now they're like, oh, okay, let's go look at all your external digital assets and do this, and they call this space digital risk management. There's a lot of stuff in here, and this is where I think the challenge is with some of these guys right now in this thing called DRM is it email? Is it web? Is it social media? Is it a combination of all of those? It's not very clear sometimes to me of what this really, really means, and then you've got various aspects of this. You've got the proof points of the world really on the email and website of this with a little bit of social media. You got Digital Shadows. What is it? Looking Glass. There's a number of them, right? Risk IQ seems to be kind of like the de facto leader in the space from a DRM perspective. Looks at as the kind of de facto leader of that category. And so, you know, what's Digital Shadows going to do to kind of differentiate itself over Risk IQ in the space? I think that's something they have to figure out if they're going to continue to make gains and momentum here.
Yeah, I think that's actually an interesting point. I'm also curious, too, to see if this is a category that stays or if this is something that transcends and becomes something bigger down the road.
It becomes something different. I'm not sure it stays the same. It's kind of confusing to me what DRM really means, but
no, I was going to say, like, I think that's the point. I think that what we're trying to take a look at, you know, because like if you look at, and I'm sure that they're not all going to say that they're the same, but if you go look at like a Cyber GRX, right, and we've talked to Fred on the program, and you go take a look at this whole concept of a digital supply chain, like and it's funny because we'll always say, well, we're good at the physical supply chain. Yeah, are we? Like, really? We're better at it. Okay, how about on the digital side? Oof. So, you know, idea of digital risk management and your digital supply chain and okay, I can see where those things might start at some point coming together.
Well, earlier in the week, and I think Paul and John covered this, is the Cyber GRX BitSight integration,
yeah,
right?
Which
was
makes a lot of sense.
Taking the BitSight score and bringing it over to enhance that, right? These guys, all of these guys have aspects of kind of what that digital potential risk footprint looks like, that external footprint that potentially is a very interesting integration point for Cyber GRX as they continue to look at the whole third-party exchange component. So, it's interesting. Those guys all have a potential play, but you can see, you know, what Fred did earlier, late last week, actually, with the BitSight integration. Those are continued, like, what other types of integrations on the Cyber GRX side make sense to enhance data collection for understanding the risk of third parties, more from an external footprint to augment what CyberGRX is doing with the internal control reviews and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because I've both talked with BitSight and CyberGRX, and I thought it made sense for both of them. Like if you go look at the way BitSight's trying to explain it, and if you push, and it's funny because I don't think anymore. Like I would say, so you guys are kind of like a credit reporting agency, and you know, 3 weeks ago they're like, yeah. Now they're like, hell no, we're not. No, don't. No, that's not us. No, we're totally different. Threat stack, $45 million Series C. So they've done two Series A's. And you know, we talked about this, but here's what's interesting. Since 2003, they've done a seed round, two A rounds, a B round, and a C round. We've talked about this before. There's a couple different ways to approach your A. One way is that you do an A, you keep the round open. So typically, you've got a valuation, you've got a raise. I want to raise $10 million. And so you might announce when you've got your first $5 million in, and the round stays open, not typically for a year, but maybe for a couple months, and then it closes. And that means all your money's in. Sometimes, too, you'll oversubscribe your A round. So your original goal was, I don't know, $8 million. You raised $12 million, and somehow you thought that made sense to take the money. I always think it's a risk, but that's cool. So you do it. But we see this new trend now where people are taking a second A. Now, to be fair, I don't know if ThreatStack did this. I didn't dig enough into their financials to figure it out. But what you'll see sometimes is I'll do an A. And then, oh, yeah, you know what? I didn't really raise enough, and we need a little bit more capital. Or sometimes somebody else wants to jump in, and I don't want to change the valuation. So it's not so much that you reopened the round, although I guess technically you did. You still call it an A in an A round. I always think it's interesting. And so it's probably just some of the stigma from the folks that I've talked to about it. When you see something like that, does it matter to you? Or are you kind of more like, where are you at now? 45 million C for a growth. I mean, C should be a growth stage. So at this point, 45 million for a company that's looking at intrusion detection, but they're looking at cloud. Is that enough for them as a Series C, you think?
Or is it too much? let me play side of that for
good
a second,
point.
Right? I always look at the number of rounds because it starts to give you an idea of are they burning a lot, right? And that's kind of an indicator, right? Because when you go to another round, that means you need funding to continue, right? And so you could see an A, a B, a C, a D. Look, Slack's at a G, and then sometimes you see this thing called an equity round, which is usually a down round, which isn't good typically, right? Because you're like, oh yeah, they need money to stay afloat, but they can't go raise money at a different valuation. So it's typically a down round. So I like to count the rounds just to understand where they are in the process. And so in theory, this is probably a D, even though they call it a C.
Right.
But you got to start looking at the money in, and you got to start thinking about, what's the valuation of this company now?
Yeah.
A $45 million round, let's just do simple math and say it's a 4Xer, and it's probably much higher than that.
Yeah,
that means
six, yeah.
$180 million, right? Where are they from a revenue perspective? Are they anywhere in that kind of valuation gap, right? This is one of the things that I take really seriously with some of the smaller startups that I'm working with is, guys, don't take a really big round unless you really need it, because what happens is the perception is sometimes that it kind of blocks you out of a potential strategic acquisition,
yeah.
Which I think are valid exits, right? And so when you take a $45 million C round and now you've got $50 million in, you know, to get a decent return, you're looking at a $200 million. If you're not doing at least $20 million in revenue, the math doesn't work, just in general, right? So I'm just... So that's kind of the digging that you got to do a little bit. So
yeah, I think sometimes people like the number, right? Like they want to project a big number and go, well, I got a big raise, so therefore we're doing awesome. And they're kind of losing sight of what is that blocking you from? And by the way, how high did you just set that bar? I don't want to talk a lot about it. And we got a couple more here, and then we're going to get to our interview. So EIQ rebrands as Sigilent. $7 million equity round. So as we just said, kind of a down round. Man, you go look at their funding history. So since 2009, they've got different rounds, different debt, different equity stuff. We'll see where they go. I want to point out this one.
Oh, rebrand. I guess, here it comes.
Yeah, right. I mean, maybe this is it though. That said, look, I'm a believer in second chances. Maybe the rebrand does it. Maybe this is the equity round. They get their stuff squared together. They figured it out. They're doing security operations. They're doing analytics. I mean, this also might just be
so are a lot of other people. So
I was just gonna say, this could just be positioning for the exit, right? So,
yeah.
All right, this one drove me nuts. Evident, $8.8 million Series A. And I was like, Evident? Wait, what? And I looked it up, and I went, oh, that's not the same company. It's not Evident.io. This is Evident ID. You know, we did get time, and this is, I always enjoy it when you and I get a chance to do this. So we're going to have to cycle some of these companies back. You go look at their homepages and you're like, wait, but what do they do? Like, is their problem clear? Did it capture my attention? And I find most of these companies, they don't. By the way, if you're listing as a vendor, not as a vendor, if you're an enterprise leader, are you doing any better internally? So this one's interesting, right? So it's a cloud-based platform. And it's identifying certifications, criminal financial background information. A Series A raise is big. It's cloud. I feel like this needs to scale a little bit. So it's interesting, maybe. I don't know. Thoughts?
Maybe. It's not a horrible round, right? My target round, I don't like A's over $7 million personally, just because I think it locks you out of strategic. So it's not horrible as a round. I guess it just depends on where they are. From an adoption and in a revenue perspective, is 8.8 the right number for them? I'm not quite sure. I didn't dig into the details on this one, primarily because I did the same thing you did. I scratched my head and went, wait, Evident.io just took a – no, wait. This is the wrong company.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, wrong company.
All right. So a couple of things that you know, and if we need to, we'll come back to these. And if we need to, we'll talk about them again next week. I'm going to just kind of hit three of these fast because this is your area. So – You can fill us in. So Aqua Security, $25 million Series B, and they've got that cool word container. I know you track that space. JASK did an undisclosed raise and an unattributed round, which to me feels like maybe someone wanted to get in and they needed to be public about it. But maybe you got some insights on that. And then Capsule 8, $6 million Series A, so they're below your $7 million cap. And they're doing cloud-native stuff. There's a lot there. The only other one that's interesting, just because we've covered them a couple times, Best Deal just did $27 million Series B. We're going to dig more into them in the future. I'm going to have to get them on board because I kind of like what they're doing, and I think it's a little different. But let's go back. So Aqua, JASK, Capsule 8, stuff you play in. Any big thoughts here that we need to think about from these?
Yeah, so let me cover JASK quickly because I think what happened here is Stuart McClure won it in. Stuart got named to the board, I think, and that is kind of the way he got in, I think, based on what I can read, is Stuart wanted in, and he's got a board seat, and I think he brought some capital in as part of that deal as an investment. So I think that's positive for JASK. I covered these guys after Black Hat, very interesting tech. To have somebody like Stuart McClure on the board and an investor, I think, is positive for them because, you know, Stuart's, you know, done really, really well with Cylance and other stuff, and so I think that's good for them. I want to talk about container security just a little bit because, you know, this is a space I track a lot. And what you see this week is two kind of big announcements, and this follows some big enterprise announcements around containers. And so I just want to do a little bit of education because I think it's interesting. Is this market's going to get a little confusing, I think. And I for listeners, I kind of want to try to help them understand how this all comes together and what these announcements mean. Look, container security is a subset of application security. But container security kind of has a couple different areas that people are focusing on. So the first one is kind of network segmentation. So you've got the Illumios and VArmors and those guys working on network micro-segmentation of the containers, right? So that's kind of a whole space in itself. You've got network monitoring folks like Netsil and some of these other guys that are kind of doing monitoring of the container environment more from a network kind of a traditional networking monitoring perspective. You've got then kind of like your deep packet inspection guys. So this is where StackRox and Capsulate, I think, really start to fall as they're trying to do more of this deep packet kind of overall monitoring of these cloud native environments, which include containers. That's kind of where those guys fit. And then you have the application centric guys. And right now it's primarily runtime application self-protection vendors, but there's also a couple others over there in really doing some embedded container stuff like Layered Insight, where they're actually embedding instrumentation inside the containers. And so you've got these different buckets coming up. So Aqua, StackRox, Capsulate all kind of fit into this kind of deeper packet inspection kind of thing. And so you got two kind of interesting announcements this week. The other thing to think about with container security, right, is so not just these different market segments, but then approaches. How do they solve it? And there's two predominant approaches in the industry right now. There's a third one emerging, which I want to talk about because I think that's the most interesting for me personally. The traditional way to do this is one is kernel. So you need a kernel level capability. That's what Aqua does. Aqua is installing kind of a kernel level agent to inspect kind of like they're underneath the container, right? Every container has to spin up a process on the host. So by sitting at the kernel, they can see and inspect these containers coming up. So they kind of sit under the container world. And that's kind of what they're doing. And they are getting some good traction in the industry. Don't get me wrong. I think this raise just kind of validates some of their growth. The second approach that you see is what I call the privileged container approach. So they're running beside containers in the environment where they have a privileged container and that privileged container can see into the other containers. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what Capsulate, StackRox, TwistLock, those guys are doing, and they're running beside. So those are the two predominant approaches. And so you see the privileged container stuff with Capsulate this week and the kernel level stuff with Aqua this week. The one that's emerging though, which I really, really like, and this is where I've been doing a lot of consulting work with, is inside the container itself. And that is instrumenting the container at inside the container. And it gives you some interesting visibility and portability that some of these other solutions don't have. And that's what's really interesting to me in the space is because when you think about the technology trends that's going on in the cloud space, think about container as a service. So running this as a platform. Are you going to run kernel agents when you don't have access to the host?
Right.
Probably not. Are you going to run a privileged container when there's other privileged containers across your customers? Maybe not. So what transforms container as a service platforms like ECS or GKE or serverless computing, right, where Lambda is going to just instantiate something and run it for a period of time and then blow it away? Again, how does a privileged container or a kernel agent fit in those environments? So the reason I like this embedded inside the container technology is it's portable across all these different environments. And so if you're looking to streamline both the DevOps and the SecOps side of this equation, then I think this emerging area of inside the container has some very interesting legs. So I watch
is that,
all
is
this.
Is this akin, like I'm a big believer that, you know, when we talk about cloud, we've got to translate functionality. So I'm translating concept. But I mean, like, I kind of heard stuff like talking about, you know, kernel levels, right? Like, we used to talk about, like, shims and stack stuff versus, like, operating in a hypervisor and having visibility. And so if you're inside a container, is that functionally like loading an agent on a machine again? Or totally different?
No, not it's different because loading an agent in a container is basically impossible because there's no operating system.
Well, and that's what I said. But is it functionally, like, functionally, that's what I'm is that a way to think about it? Functionally?
Kinda. Yeah, functionally, maybe. I think there's a I'll have to figure out how to
describe
it.
There's probably a better way. Yeah, fair point.
Right, exactly. And look, we could do a whole session on all of this at some point in the future. But what I'm looking for is technologies that transcend certain market trends. And we've got to think about some of these things differently than the way we've thought about them in the past, right? Look, today, when customers move to containers, they start on-prem, and so they own the infrastructure. Then they move to dedicated instances in the cloud, so they still have access to the endpoints because they're running Kubernetes in a dedicated instance environment. But let's say that I want to move that to GKE or to ECS now. There's a layer that gets taken out in the cloud environments, and what technologies transcend when that happens, when these platform as a services for containers continue to evolve and gain adoption, certain technologies get locked out, I think, in potential cases because you no longer have these endpoints or you don't have the ability to run privileged containers anymore. Right now, it works okay. I'm looking for those really cool technologies that say, wait a minute, it doesn't matter if serverless computing and container as a service take over or not, my technology still works. So this is an evolving space. It's going to continue to grow, and I think you're going to continue to see more and more announcements in this space.
And that's why, if you're watching and you're in the enterprise today, pay attention to this type of stuff because we're going to guide you through what to look for, especially when we bring Matt on. We'll talk about these types of things. There is a, we covered a ton. We're going to come back. We're going to circle back on some of these over the next couple of weeks. And every time we bring Matt back, we're going to do a better job. Well, hopefully there's not going to be 11 freaking stories in a week. And we'll be able to break down some of their pages and start talking about the value because I think that's where we're going to really be able to help everybody. But up next, we've got Don Pizzette, Tim Broom. They're going to join us again. We're going to talk about IP tools, some of the, or not IP tools, rather. We're going to talk about IPC Pro TV and some of the exciting stuff we got going on. We'll be right back after this break with that interview.
Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested these public assets? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night.
We are back in our Upside Down series. It's Security Weekly, episode 56. And we just covered an impressive amount of security news this week, and we're going to get ready to talk with Don and Tim from IT Pro TV. But first, a couple quick announcements. ITProTV/startup security. Use the code SS30. Try it free for 7 days. Receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solutions, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal and stick around because I'm going to talk to them about some of the stuff that they've got in some ways it's going to help you be a better security leader, to do better in your security startups, to understand it all. So there's a lot of exciting stuff we're going to talk about. So you're going to want to remember that code because this is going to be your entry to it. Also, you can check out Logarithm's webcast. It's coming up Tuesday, September 26th. That's next week. 3 to 4 p.m., Logarithm's Greg Foss is developing an open-source tool set called the Phishing Intelligence Engine. It's going to help streamline and automate the entire process of tracking, analyzing, and responding to phishing emails without the need for commercial software. Register for this webcast to hear Greg, Paul Asadorian, John Strand weigh in on phishing attack detection and response and how you can use open-source tools to automate these processes. Go register now, securityweekly.com/logarithm. All right, so let's get down to it. So Don and Tim are back. They're from IT Pro TV. They're great supporters of the program, and we have great conversations. I've been looking forward to this all summer. So Don, Tim, welcome back, and excited to have you back on Startup Security Weekly.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us back.
Yeah, I love the setup. I love all the stuff you guys are doing. So let's talk for a little bit then. So we just covered, there's so much going on in the security space. And what we've been also talking to people about a little bit here is that when you look at the startup side, we're still looking at the enterprise place. We've got people that are trying to secure their startups, and they need to think a little differently now because we see that these vectors and these third-party risks are they're increasing. We've got people that are security leaders that are trying to evaluate startups and understand something. And one of the things that we talked about in an earlier segment was if you want to hire for a position, sometimes you've got to have the right skill set. You've got to actually do the job first yourself. And one of the things that you and I were just talking about were red team, blue team, and some of the training and some of the things that you guys have done around that. And in my mind, it makes a perfect fit. So tell us a little bit about some of that red team, blue team stuff and how that's working out. And what people can expect from that.
Yeah, you know, when we launched our company, we were creating an IT training organization that trained in a slightly different way, but we were really covering content that a lot of other organizations have already done, like certification training, which is very valuable. But once you get out there in the field, once you've got that job and you're working, the certification isn't as important as the actual skill is. And what we found was this kind of gap in the marketplace where there's not a lot of organizations that are teaching the practical hands-on skill without a huge price tag attached to it. And it's also kind of a one-size-fits-all solution for security training. And so we looked at it and said that there's got to be a better way to do that, to get in there and create something a little more customized that says, hey, not everybody is a penetration tester. There's plenty of people out there that are sysadmins that are the ones responsible for securing a network. Or if you are a pen tester, you need to know how people secure a network, but you're really attacking the network. It's a different skill set. And so training really needs to be customized that way, where you've got red team training, where you've got blue team training. And sure, you might have some people that want to attend both, but usually people will kind of shift into the category that meets their needs. So they might both need to learn how to use a tool like Nmap. but a penetration tester is going to use Nmap differently than a blue teamer would. So that's kind of the approach that we're taking, is we want to make sure that we have that content that's right for the skill that a person needs.
So how did you start looking at red team versus blue team? So I like this. I like this a lot. I want to talk about that in a second, but take me through. You're right. It's an interesting evolution, because a lot of us, you know, if you've got training, we want to tie that training to a certification or something I can show HR or somebody else and say, look, we spent the money. It was a good choice. And what you're saying is, yeah, that's nice. There's an importance to that. But if you want to be good at your job, if you want to continue to grow, here's how we do it. And I know you guys, I'm impressed at how often you refresh the content and update stuff. We've talked about that before, and I think it's a great approach. So how did you start putting this together? How did you figure out what to focus on? Why red team versus blue team? What's that experience like?
So it actually came from a conversation we had with Scott Lyons and Josh Marpet from Red Lion, who I know you're familiar with, that we were talking about it. And you know, our biggest challenge as a company for creating training is finding an expert. You know, where do you find a person who's an expert in skill X or product Y? And Scott and Josh were telling us all these different people they knew that could come in and fill in that gap. But they were always very specialized. And they would say, well, this person would be really good on the pen testing side, but not good on the defense side, or vice versa. And as we talked with them more and more, we came to realize that it's not just the teachers that specialize, it's the employees themselves that specialize. So it makes sense to have the training lined up. And from there, you know, Tim was the one who kind of said, you know, let's create a business model out of this. Let's bring that into our subscription or our regular packages and just really shake up the industry with a new type of training that can really reach out there. So that's kind of how it started.
And I think you know, we're just now approaching 4 years old, so the content that we've created has been very specific, geared towards the certification base and all the way up through different certifications for security. It might be like CISSP, Certified Ethical Hacker. But when you go beyond that, how do you actually learn how to be a penetration tester, or how do you learn how to be a true hardener of networks unless you're working for somebody and you do a lot of on-the-job training or forums or groups or trade shows? There are some people that offer some of the instructor-led training that can be quite expensive, but we've always wanted to kind of be the training for everybody, that you don't have to be part of that. So we want to make a price point that allows everyone to have access to it. So how do we do that? We do that by finding great people who can come in and explain it in the format that we have, and we keep it updated. So we're excited about getting that ramped up and going through the end of this year and starting next year really strong on both sides of that, red and blue.
Now, is that part of the subscription that people already have? Is that how you decided to roll this out?
It is, as opposed to, it kind of goes back to like the way we try to operate our business and take care of our members, as opposed to a separate Security Pro subscription, we're going to have it in the IT Pro library. So if you're a subscriber to IT Pro TV, you have access to all of that content.
That's awesome.
Including all the red and blue training that you're going to have.
And, you know, we bounced that around a bit because it was kind of a tough decision, because we could have launched it as its own product and just said, you know, let's start securitypro.tv or
probably
or
got a higher price point.
Yeah, compared to the industry. But, you know, our goal with IT Pro TV was always, let's have all the IT training you'd want right here in one spot and make it accessible. And branching out into a separate product kind of defeats that. I mean, it makes sense sometimes when the topic is so different, but everyone in IT needs to be learning security right now. It's not like just the security officers need it. So that changes things.
No, I liked it a lot. And I want to take a second, too, and talk about it, because you pointed out something I think is really important. And I heard something else. I want to push on it. Finding qualified instructors is a challenge. I mean, this was a challenge 20 years ago in security, because security is moving fast. And it requires a slightly different mindset. So then to be able to teach about it, you actually have to understand it at a fundamental level and then break down what you did and then explain it consistently. And so there's finding somebody who's qualified. But then you also said something, Tim, about, you know, needs to be able to fit into our process. And what I get the sense is that you guys have really spent time figuring out. I've been really impressed when you talk about how you measure stuff and how you're tracking it, how you're looking at feedback, how you're looking at engagement. So has that really helped you? Can you find an expert now who's really good at what they do, can explain it fairly well, has a good voice, has the ability to explain it, and are you then able to kind of guide them so that you're really extracting that value out and presenting it in a way that the audience is really able to act on it? Is that part of what makes this so successful?
I think it's one of the most important things that we have when it comes in the area of security, and really in a lot of things, but mainly in security, is that we have people who have true hands-on experience that do this all the time. So, you know, our plan, the people that we've talked to about doing this are the professionals that are doing this every week, not teaching, but actually performing and honing those skills so they know what the latest is out there in the world when it comes to trying to hack or harden. So taking those people who with the real-world skills who may have teaching skills, but it's really the knowledge that's most important. And then when you engage in the format that we have a like a host, what we call a host and a subject matter expert, and having that conversation, it lets a person who might not be used to teaching and communicating like that much more relaxed, and that's where we bring personality to information. So it's more of a casual engagement of communicating, like a conversational, like here, there's eight of my friends, let's talk about how to do this. And that allows people who are professionals in the world to come in and do that, don't you agree?
Yeah, and, you know, it's actually not that hard for us to find people that are really talented in a particular product or skill, people that are really good penetration testers. You know, we're fortunate to know a lot of people that do that. But it's really hard to find somebody who really knows the product and can talk, you know, that has good personal skills, that can communicate and give you a good learning experience. So that's really been the challenge. And so we've been getting out there kind of like the social butterflies of IT and trying to meet as many people as we can to find those people, because it is a rare gem to find somebody who's not an introvert, you know, and can actually talk.
You know, maybe in IT, but a developer with personality, that's tough. So I think we have a unicorn.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, too, then this is why I love the way that you're looking at bringing a lot of this stuff to people. And I've been following you guys on Facebook, and I watched some of the live videos that you guys push out. I mean, the quality is fantastic. I mean, I get jealous watching you guys right now with the setup going, oh man, I totally need some of that. So you guys are definitely investing in things that make sense, but you're right. I mean, Tim, as you're talking about it, you make it conversational, you can draw the stuff out, and you're right, Don, too. There's having knowledge and there's being able to convey and communicate that knowledge. But then by you sifting through it and finding it and adding that into the subscription, it's a huge benefit for people, because you're essentially taking the risk away. You're saying, look, you like all the other stuff that we've done, then trust us that we're going to keep bringing this stuff to you. And I like that. I like that a lot. Let's go back for a second, red team, blue team, and I'll share something I think is kind of interesting. And I'm curious, I know you guys are just doing this, I'm curious if you're seeing any of this yet, or some insights you might have for current subscribers or people who want to try out that 7-day trial and see what this is like. I've had a number of security leaders, both on the startup side. One of the things that happens a lot if I take a briefing is I'll talk to a startup leader and I'll say, what does a security leader in the enterprise today need to know? So I'm not just talking about the people doing the enterprise level stuff and getting their jobs done and doing them well. I'm asking about the leaders. And a trend I've noticed that's been popping up over the last couple of weeks is they really need to understand red teaming. They need to understand it. They don't have to be experts at it, but they need to understand it. So as soon as you talked about having insights and training on red team and blue team, I went, oh, that's fantastic. Because I got another pitch briefing a while ago that said that they think security leaders and startup leaders should moonlight doing things like bug bounties and doing side projects. And we've heard for years people should try open source stuff. And so as I'm talking to you guys, I'm sitting here saying, whoa, so what you're telling me is, right, and we've already talked about bringing your team in and using the supervisor portal. What I've seen a lot, and I'm curious if you guys are seeing the same thing, a lot of times somebody say, well, this is great for my team. And I'll say, cool, what training did you do? Oh, well, yeah, I'm very busy. I don't have time. And we talked right before we came on air about, you know, what are we doing for leaders? What are we doing for leadership? What I kind of like about this is if you're a security leader today, you need to kind of keep up with what blue team stuff is, but there's no better way now to get your head wrapped around some red team stuff than being able to do some of this. So are you seeing an uptick in that? Are you looking at how that's working out? And does this maybe create an opportunity for somebody who is a team leader, who already got their certifications, that now, whoa, they can get in and they're going to lead by example with their team, and they can sit around and they can talk about some of the different training. What are you guys finding so far as you're rolling this out to folks?
So what we've found is that it's not realistic to say like the CIO should attend web application penetration testing courses, right? So it's not, I mean, it might be nice, but it's just not realistic for that to happen. They're focused on business, and a lot of times they're people who hold MBAs, and they're very smart at what they do, but they're not security professionals. And so what we did is, and this was actually, I want to give full credit to Red Lion on this one, right? So Scott and Josh had a great idea. They said, you know, red team is good, blue team is good, and sometimes people cross a line and you get purple team or pink or whatever color you want to go with it, where it blends. But they suggested that we do two other tracks, and we're rolling forward with this, which they dubbed one the yellow team, which was security for people who are architects. If you're designing a network, if you're designing a solution, you need to be designing security into that. And so there will be soon training that's built around that, but also a dedicated management track. A track that was focused on managers, because a manager, they need to understand what HIPAA compliance is. They need to understand what PCI compliance is and what requirements there are. They might not be the person doing the pen testing. They might not be the person actually implementing the backup, but they need to be aware that they need it and understand that it's not a, how do I justify this? It's a, I do this because it's legally required and I've got to do it. So we'll actually be creating content that is specifically tailored to those managers. And, some of it will be like abbreviated content where they get it in a shorter format because that's the realistic amount of time they have. But other content will be very in-depth based on what their need is. So trying to create that role-based training, I think, is important to keep people engaged and learning what they feel is most important.
Yeah, and our roadmap has some information for C-suite also. So imagine you're in a boardroom and a company is talking about a malware or ransomware, and they fully don't understand the pain points and what the potential could be. Well, we have smaller courses that we have that will be like 2 hours. It's actually on the CompTIA track that they're rolling out for all the different C-suites. So it's not just the security manager. It would be all C-suites managers to be able to access that information to make better decisions.
That sounds compelling. That sounds like you're definitely fitting an area that makes sense. All right, talk to me a little about the experience then. So I want to go learn more about red team stuff. Are you tracking how people use this? Because I'm personally always interested. Are people sitting down? Are they giving it an hour a day? Is it they're grabbing a couple minutes here, a couple minutes there? What do you recommend when somebody engages on the platform? What should they be looking for? And who's most successful? How do they need to think about approaching the training that you guys are able to provide people?
So when we designed our training, it was designed to be easy to consume, right? We film it in a TV show format, not a classroom format. So it's not like you need to say, I'm going to dedicate an hour and just focus right on the screen and watch this. It's more like a TV show. You can certainly focus in on it and watch it, or you can just play it in the background while you're doing your job. And we find a lot of people do that. We'll see some people have 6 hours of viewing a day. And you look at that, and I went to college. I know that I could not learn for 6 hours in a row. And it's just not my style. But to have a TV on while I'm doing my regular work, that's a pretty easy thing to do. And people respond to that well.
Yeah, there's about 25 or 30% that are watching it on a TV on a Roku or Apple TV device. And then we have another good portion that on a mobile device that might be streaming the audio only because they're in a train or commute. So I think people will consume it however is best fits their needs. Same way you might listen to a podcast, give me 30 minutes to an hour a day whenever I get a chance.
Yeah,
there are people that really focus on what they have to learn because of a work product or a work function.
For the people that are studying for like a certification, they're the ones who will nail down a rigid schedule. They'll say, I'm going to study 1 hour a day. Okay. I'm really going to focus. But when it's a real world skill, a lot of times people just leave it on in the background and they'll kind of listen. And when they hear a skill being talked about that they recognize as something they can use, like, whoa, wait a minute, let me watch this.
Yeah.
And they start, kind of paying attention.
A good IT pro is always learning.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what I find is one of the best experiences.
I like that a lot. All right, so I love the fact that you guys are always looking at this, you're always innovating. It was a couple months ago. What's something that's kind of surprised you? So as you've looked over the summer, as you've kept looking at what's working and where you're going, and obviously you've introduced some changes, what was one of the ahas that you've had over the last couple months in terms of either how people are consuming content or something that's kind of shifted the way that you guys are thinking about things, maybe that led to the red team, blue team, security pro stuff, maybe something different? What's kind of, if you think back over the last 2-3 months, what's shifted?
I'll go real quick. We were talking about the quality of the product that we have, and we brought in a director of production who has 25 years of television experience. And he wow. ran and started the SEC Network here at University of Florida for like 185 games per year for the Gators. And to have him come in and dial in our cameras and the quality of our lighting, if you tune into the live feed today, and they're probably still going if you're live for another hour or two, that live feed is just incredibly awesome. It looks like it's 4K. It is really good. So you say, what's the wow thing? Is I didn't think that the quality of our stream could really get better, and it really has. And we're making investments in the right kind of people to bring a better experience to all of our members. So we're always looking to do that.
Yeah, and I know for me, every now and then we'll have a host or an SME or somebody who's here, and they'll have a little downtime. And so they'll get in front of the camera and just kind of film some random content, just something for the heck of it. And every now and then we'll film something like that, and the viewers will just love it. They'll eat it up, and it'll lead to more content. And we've had that happen a few times over the last couple of years. But over this summer, I know I started a Linux track, just you know, standard Linux training. And because of people deploying in the cloud more, we're seeing Linux in pretty much every company, even companies that used to be entirely Microsoft shops. And that type of training has really started to rocket forward. And I created a specific securing Linux series, like just security techniques. And not only did the viewers like it, but they started suggesting things like, hey, you should do an episode on fail to ban or this product or that product. And so we just started adding it to that content and growing it as the week went on. You know, we kept adding more stuff to it. It turned out to be a lot of fun. And the view rate on that, like the viewer numbers are just through the roof. So it gives us a chance to kind of feel the pulse of the industry and see what people are looking for. And as long as we're dynamic and fast about it, you know, we're a small company, we're agile, we can create that content really quick. People eat it up. That's worked out well for us.
You know, that's one of the things I like to mention in the areas of security. Because our format, the way that we create, if we create content on Monday, it's on the web on Tuesday night or Wednesday morning. So within 24 to 48 hours, that course that we created or that episode, those three or four episodes that we'll do in a morning or afternoon, is on the web 2 days later. When you're teaching about security, it is the fastest access to that content absent of a live class. So that is critically important and one of the reasons that we want to specialize in the areas of security.
Yeah, I love that. And that's one of the things that really impressed me as I talked to you guys is that you've really looked at the process of that. And as you just pointed out, right, you're still amplifying the production, bringing it up. And, you know, Don, you just kind of pointed to another question that I had. So how much of the new content that you guys are developing is based on your scouring and reading headlines and talking to people and listening? Or are you at the point now where you can both look at the numbers and the trends and people are writing in, what about this, what about this, what about this? Are you at that point where a lot of the growth is almost organic because you're just responding to the questions that your members have?
We get a lot of that, and we probably could rely just on that at this point, but we don't. I always worry that sometimes there's news articles, there's things that hit the newswire that the media presents a certain way that's not necessarily accurate. And so we'll get a lot of viewers that'll reach out to us and say, oh, you really need to tell us about this problem. It's an epidemic. It's horrible. And we look at it and we're like, well, really, it's actually not that bad. And if you just patch your servers like you're supposed to, then it's really not a big deal. That's the real epidemic is people not patching their servers. But, you know, the media will blow up just about anything. So we always try and watch both. That way we've got a good ground on the data we represent.
I like that. All right, so let's talk a little bit more then. You said you're doing some stuff for the C-suite and you're looking more at it. And I know we've talked before about leadership. How do you start to incorporate stuff like that into your library, right? Because you've already made a successful transition from helping people get prepared for certifications. And now you're saying, no, security is dynamic. And as you point out, Tim, I think it's really important. We can record on Monday and you've got value on Wednesday. That's huge. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, one of the trends we're seeing is a lot of folks are being promoted. There's a new demand for CISOs. There's a new demand for security leadership. And I think a lot of people are kind of waking up one day and saying, wait, I'm a leader now? okay, what do I need to do? And maybe it's not that blunt. Right? And so I'm not trying to disparage anybody, but if they've already got access to a training library like yours and that type of content, what should they be looking for in terms of how IT Pro is going to help them as their career progresses to start to think about some of these things? How are you guys thinking about that? And what's available today or what can people start looking forward to?
Well, you know, in the area of always creating content that's effective for us, the BizPro Library, we talked a little bit about it last time, for that areas of entrepreneurship, leadership, teams, and sales. And you're right, when someone continues to get promoted who might not, maybe in IT and maybe already intellectually has been gaming their whole life, so their social skills might not be as great. When you're leading a team, it has to do with a lot of trusting your team, empowering your team, teaching your team, counting on your team, and you got to build that team structure because you're only as successful as your weakest link in the power of your team. So we have some John Spence, who's a professional speaker who happens to live in Gainesville. He's helped us create some content. We have a roadmap for many more about leading effective teams and leading technology teams. So it specifically addressed those types of issues for people to how to be a better leader. Because there are many opportunities that if you can have everyone around you be just as strong and they're fighting for your back, they'll do anything for you. And that's what ultimately you want and will make your organization successful.
And we've started branching into other areas like ITIL and ISO 20000. I know PMIs, PMP, Project Management, Agile. Those are all leadership, we'll call them technologies, right? It's not a software program that you run, but it's a skill and a technique for managing your organization. And a lot of people, if they would manage their environment using ITIL practices, for example, and in those practices, it calls for proper security at certain steps along the way. You know, it all goes hand in hand if management puts it in place, if they use the right framework. And if they're just learning or just starting from scratch, don't reinvent the wheel. There's a ton of other companies that have already been through this, so you benefit from frameworks like ITIL to be able to say, yep, all right, I don't know what I'm doing, but let me structure off of this because these are recommended best practices. So we found that content, while it's not an IT-type thing in the traditional sense, it's not setting up a server, it's the processes around it that's equally important, and so we started incorporating that into our library.
And I'm not trying to make this sound like an infomercial or anything, but when you're an IT Pro subscriber, you get the BizPro library, so it's already included in your subscription. You also get the That's Office awesome. Pro and the Dev Pro for developer content, all the DevOps type subjects.
Yeah, look, I'm always interested in the business models, right, and the way that we think about this type of stuff. And I personally favor the approach that you guys are using, which is let's just keep expanding value, let's keep adding it in. But you know, even as I'm listening to you now, I come across a lot of people that are newer in their careers, and they'll say stuff like, well, I'm not a leader yet, but I want to be. And what I just heard, Don, was that, but they don't have to get PMP certified, but if they want to go understand the basics of it, or they want to become, right, I think a lot of times in our culture, and definitely in technology, we'll substitute familiarity for a concept for some actual competence in it. If they're an IT Pro TV member, subscriber, then they actually get the ability to gain some of that competence, but they can at least gain a much clearer understanding of it, which if you think that you want to be a manager one day, or you want to move into a position of leadership, or you want to just be more effective where you are, as you said, you don't always have to recreate the wheel. So I like the idea that as a leader, I can go learn more about red team stuff and I can try it. No one's going to expect you to turn into a pen tester overnight. And I'm certainly not suggesting people moonlight as pen testers. But if you want to go talk to red team, or you want to go hire people better, having a fundamental understanding of their skill sets is certainly going to be important. So are you starting to see people do some of that cross training on their own? Or when they're a member, do you suggest ideas for people? Do you help them kind of carve a path through things and help them fill their docket? How does that work? What's that experience like?
Yeah, you know, when we were in our early days, when the company was new, we only had a handful of courses. Our library wasn't that large. And over the years, we create new content every single day. Now we've got 5 studios turning out content. Our library has grown to be really large. And we found that people were getting lost. You know, it's like stumbling into the jungle looking for one particular tree. That's kind of what we had. And so we started creating career roadmaps, which were like guidelines that would say, what exactly is it you intend to do? Do you want to become a CIO? Do you want to be a pen tester? Well, here's where you need to go from the beginning all the way to that position, and kind of walking through each step along that way. And it's important that if somebody wants to be on the defense side, or if they want to become a red team pen tester or whatever, that they get the fundamentals, that they start at the beginning and they move through it. And they might already have the real world experience that lines up with that, so they can skip things. But you want to skip things you already know. You don't want to skip things you don't know. And so how do you identify that? So we've started to create roadmaps, and we actually have a career concierge, which is one of my favorite features of the company, where if you just don't know, you can call and talk to Marisha or somebody, and they'll give you advice and help walk you through the areas you should be studying and the courses that line up best with what you want. But at the end of the day, you might just feel like learning something, not even necessarily job-related. Hey, I want to learn more about databases. And so you watch a few videos, you start to learn about databases, and who knows, maybe that spurs you on to a great career as a DBA, or you realize, wow, databases suck, I don't want to do that. It's up to you.
I had this conversation with one of my team members this week, and we were talking about, you know, where he might fit in the future. And I kind of had I gave him the Wayne Gretzky quote of skate where the puck is going to be. Well, if you do that for your career, where do you want to be when a position opens up in a year? You need to already be prepared for that, and not in a year say, hey, I want to start to do that. You need to start now and start preparing, whether it's you want to be on a red team or you want to be in leadership or whatever it might be. Learn now and start immersing yourself. Stop listening to the radio or watching stupid TV shows. You know, invest in yourself and make those sacrifices. They'll pay off in a very short period of time.
Yeah, well, and you know, if they're going to just watch TV anyway, at least now they can get broadcast quality from you guys and enjoy it. So then one last piece then. I'm going to go to the other side of it. You know, we see a lot of startups are forming up. We had a guy in an interview last week who said, you know, it's interesting. We keep saying we've got a shortage of people to do security work, and yet we have, you know, 2,000 startups. We have security people jumping into it. There's kind of a disconnect here. But we do know that there are a lot of organizations that are kind of struggling with it. And what it sounds like is if they had a subscription, they can take people that have the right aptitudes, the right interests, the right skill sets, and they can start to develop the skills that they need to be on the red team internally or to be on a blue team or to start to make that work out. Are you seeing an uptick in that? Are there people that are coming to you to say, you know what we've decided is instead of trying to hire for something that maybe we don't understand, we have good people internally. Maybe they're working a help desk today. Maybe they're doing some sort of desktop or admin support. They've expressed an interest in security. This is a cost-efficient way and a successful way to keep them on the job working with us and the train up. Is that happening? Maybe is that even the core of your business? Or is that something that maybe we need people to think about a little bit differently because we can help them start to solve some of the perception of a shortage?
You know, I will say that, yes, there is an uptick in that. We are seeing more people trying to develop their own in-house talent. But I want to add more to that, though, and say that it's a bad idea to do that exclusively. Like, if you just decide, boy, we need a better security infrastructure, so I'm going to take three people that just they like computers, and I'm going to run them through a training program, and now I've got my own red team, blue team, my chief security officer or whatever – It's not a good idea to build your entire security around green professionals, you know, people that are brand new into the field that have learned on their own or at their own pace. You definitely want to at least have a leader with some experience behind them, right? And then, you know, using tools like Nessus and Nmap and Burp Suite, you can learn how to run those tools. You can learn how to run those scans and do them effectively. But how do you know if it's enough? How do you know if you've seen enough of your environment? And really, real-world knowledge is where you get that. So if you're building your entire department off of simply, you know, completely self-trained people with no field experience, you may luck out. And they may be great and find everything, and it's wonderful. But there's not really a good substitute for field experience, for actually getting out there and doing that work. So while you can certainly use a program like ours to educate and develop your talent and get them to a higher level, you want to make sure that you are mixing in real-world experience, that you are mixing in people from outside. So and I kind of equate this to the 1980s, where in the 1980s, an IT guy was a photocopier technician, right? You know, everybody had a copy machine, but they didn't necessarily have computers. And over time, more and more companies had computers, and the first actual IT people were simply whoever it was in the office that managed to clean a virus the first time. You know, so, oh, I cleaned a virus off my computer home. Congratulations, you're the new IT guy. So, you know, with security, you don't want that. You don't want somebody saying, well, hey, this one time I ran malware bytes and I cleaned off a malware package. And that's not your next chief security officer, at least not right then. They need to get experience. They need to get out there and do it. Now, the thing is, it's hard to go out and get experience if no one will hire you without experience, right? There's that gap. And that's where we come in, is that we can train you and start to give you those skills and give you a practical trade that you can apply to then get out there and do it. But I always recommend a mixture, that you can develop your own in-house talent, but mix in some real-world experience in there to really get a good, stable team.
And I'll say on the enterprise level, we have seen an uptick of accounts where they're requesting it for 2,000 users or 3,500 users. So what I believe to be happening when we have the discussions is they're getting more for everyone, so everyone has access to the information. And I believe that they're going to be making course assignments for that end-user security awareness training that we have.
Sure.
So I see an uptick in that. Security is obviously important. Every time this most recent event with Equifax happens, something like that happens, that it becomes much more aware, so people have an emphasis on it. So, you know, those type of incidents, unfortunately, happen to be great business for us because all of a sudden everybody wants to jump in.
Yeah, we actually just created a couple of video series. There was one that was just 45 minutes long. It's the shortest course on our entire site, but it was designed as an onboarding video. So you hire a new employee, regardless of their position, right? They could be the CEO or they could be the mailroom clerk, and they watch this 45-minute video, and it gives them the basic responsibilities that an employee has for security, you know, the very simple things. And then we did I think it was like a six-hour version of that, which was the punishment video. So somebody just made a mistake and clicked on a link in a phishing mail. So, okay, now they've got to come and watch this six-hour series, and now they get it more in-depth. And then you get the actual security training that's designed for the IT professionals. So kind of addressing those different needs is an important part of any kind of training program.
I love it. I love it. I love talking to you guys. This is so much fun. All right, so what do we have looking forward to between now and the end of the year? You've got Security Pro rolling out. You just mentioned you got some security awareness stuff. What are some of the things that people can look forward to between now and the next time we get a chance to talk to each other?
I would say stuff that you'll won't see, but things will perform better, is a lot of infrastructure on the back end. This year has kind of been a year of infrastructure for us, and moving to our new facility at the end of last year, rebuilding a lot of the back end of our website. There'll be some front end changes that, you know, as we talk about the number of courses that we've created, that things kind of get lost. Unfortunately, that's kind of happened. It's been a good problem, but it's happened. So we're going to have a new user interface, which I think will be dynamic, and each user will get identify much more information that's relevant to them. Like, what are people like you watching the most of? So people can be aware, kind of a social side of it, aware of what others are watching, because maybe they need to take a course like that. So that will be rolling out by the end of the year, and then launching the Office Pro, the Dev Pro, and the Biz Pro as a $9, $14, $24 type of subscription.
Yep, there's that, and then I think you'll be really surprised, and I want to throw some kudos out to Scott and Josh at Red Lion. They have helped us line up some talent for the security track that are just amazing people. They're big names, names you guys will recognize, and so I think if you come to us 3 months or even 5 months from now, you're going to see some training in there that is just really impressive stuff that I think will really, really make a big difference out there in the security world.
That's awesome. That's really exciting, and I'm going to look forward. You know, as soon as you said it, Tim, I love this idea of here's what people like you were doing, right? I mean, Amazon does that, right? Here, people that bought that book also like these books. You bought that thing, you like these things. I'm going to be really curious to see how that works out, and it sounds really compelling. That's great. And Scott and Josh are fantastic. They're good friends of the program, doing a lot for it. So I'm excited. I get excited every time I talk to you guys. So I'm already looking forward to the next time. And thanks for sharing with us and helping people figure out how to make their journey a little bit better. I gave everybody the code already. So if they just go to itpro.tv, startup security, use code SS30, you get a free 7-day trial and you get 30% off your monthly membership, which is absolutely fantastic. Anything else, guys, that people should think about or know to come check you guys out?
I was just going to say, reach out anytime. I'd love to have a conversation with you about an update on the Series A raising that we're working on.
Oh, yeah. All right. I'll follow up on that. I'll look forward to that, actually. That'll be a blast. All right. Cool. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Don. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, everybody, for listening. It was a big week. Lots of stuff here. Episode 56 is in the books. Paul will be back next week. I'll be here, and I'll still be a sand hobo. Have a great week.